Okay, tonight is the February 15th, and this is the 13th lecture of the Life and Times, I guess the time of Shabbosai Tzvi. Tonight we're going to be talking about a really an extraordinary person in history, one who is... Oh, that's right. That's right. Sorry, middle. There you go. Right. I forgot. So we're going to be talking about somebody who has who had a tremendous effect on Klal Yisrael back then and even to today, and that's we're going to be talking about the Besht, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov is what his name was, and he was a remarkable person, and he came in at the right time. Like to save a tremendous segment of Klal Yisrael, if not all of Klal Yisrael. So what I first would like to start a little just historical biographical background of the Besht, and then we'll talk about some of his influence, some of his ideas, and we'll see also how the Besht, I guess I would say off the bat, where he comes in. The Klal Yisrael, at least in the Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, went through two devastating events. One event was the Khmelnytsky's rebellion, Gezeirus Tach V'Tat, 1648 to 1649, where they say as many as 100,000 Jews were killed, exiled or... just destroyed by the Cossacks. And then after that there was plagues, and just the entire area community, which was a flourishing community, which was a wealthy community, which was a community steeped in Torah, became a very poor, oppressed community. And then on the heels of that there came another event, and that was Shabbosai Tzvi, which is, he came across, he was a Mashiach, and after such a terrible event, this is the Gezeirus Tach V'Tat, after Gog U'Magog, the war of Gog U'Magog, and then you would come with, Mashiach, and everybody expected him to be Mashiach, and miracles, so to speak, were being done, and it ended in disaster when they realized he was not the real Mashiach. And whether it was that he became a Muslim or whatever that was, but then that was another blow to the Jewish people. So now you had the people from 1640s and then 1650s. So now you would have people there that are just like, they're poor, and there's poverty, and there are problems. Plus that you would also have people that secretly still believe in Shabbosai Tzvi. And this is the time when you'll have the Besht is going to come and change things. Many people were very sincere in their Yiddishkeit, but they were too poor to send their kids to yeshiva. To have kids learn, only those that were rich, and this is the type of community that the Besht is going to come in and have a tremendous change. So Rav Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, like I mentioned, he came in, and his effects were then and today all Chassidim. Like today, all really come based from the Baal Shem Tov. I mentioned these two as well. Okay. Many children, again, they did not have the ability to study Torah. Only just a wealthy, those that had enough that could afford a melamed, those were the ones that studied Torah. But most of them, most of the Jews in Eastern Europe, at least in the Ukraine area or Eastern Poland, they were ignorant. Okay, and fine. Now came now the Besht parents. So his father was a person by the name of Eliezer, and it seems that there were these like groups of hidden tzaddikim. They would get together, and they would have learning groups, whether it was Nigla and Kabbalah, and they would try to see what they could do to be mechazik themselves and to be mechazik the people around them. So the father of the Besht Eliezer was actually a member of one of these. In their old age, in the year 1698, they gave birth to their only child, Yisrael. This is about the Besht. When he was,
how old were his parents?
I don't know, but they were elder, like, whatever. Within 5 years, when he was five, his parents passed away. Both his parents, by the time he was five, he was a yasam. I mean, a real yasam, no father, no mother. So, before his death, he's quoted as saying, his father said to him, fear no one but Hashem, love every Jew with all your heart, no matter who he is. Okay, and he grew up in the town, this was, if I'm saying it right, Tlust. And the people in the town, that's it, they saw this Yasam, so among themselves, they took care of this boy. And, you know, they would take care of his needs, and maybe went from one family to another, and they would, like, send him to a cheder. But he would find himself wandering out in the fields. That's where he was. He loved the countryside. He loved the nature. Okay, and that's where he would. That's where they would find him. I think at one point they would scream at him, "What are you doing there?" But then after they realized, "What do you want from the kid? He's a good kid, behaving himself. He does what's right. He likes to go out into the forest. So let him go out to the forest. What's the big deal?" Okay, and one time, as he got older, again, a lot of what we know about the Besht is shrouded in legend. Now, some things, you know, are true and some things are not true. Again, there's a lot of stories that are said about the Besht. I think everything here is pretty much along the lines that are true, but is it possible that the stories were off a little bit? It's not exactly, it could be. But this is what they said about it. One time, Yisrael was outside in the field and he saw this old man, a saintly man, and he's sitting and learning in the forest. And basically, Rabbi Yisrael has started up a conversation with him. And before you know it, they were learning together. And Yisrael decided to follow him around. This person was some sort of a peddler, some sort of a merchant who would go from town to town, and Rabbi Yisrael would follow him. And whenever they had a chance, when they were alone, he would sit and he would learn with him. And this is the person that taught Yisrael what he wanted. Well, he taught Yisrael, as he grew up. So, how old was the Besht at the time? He's very, very young. I don't know, was he 6 years old, 7 years old, 10 years old? I'm not sure. But that's what he found himself doing, traveling with this person from village to village. Okay. At one point, we do know that he was a teacher's assistant. So he was, at some point, this person introduced him to somebody who was a Rebbe who would have little cheder kids. And he was his assistant, and he would help him out, and he would go around the village, and he would gather all the children, and he would bring them to the Rebbe to learn. It says a lot of stories about him doing this. One is, I don't know if I have the story here, but one time there was he would teach them and he would sing with them, and they'd be singing beautiful songs as they went through the town. Over here, the Maggid of Meserich, which is his Talmud, who took over basically after the Besht, took over the movement, was said about the Besht, "If only we kissed the Torah scroll with the same love that the Baal Shem kissed the children when he took them to Cheder as a teacher's assistant." Wow, the love that he showed these kids. We should have that love when we kiss the Sefer Torah. It was one story where there was the Satan, they didn't like the fact that all these kids were singing so nicely and it was going to bring Mashiach. So he decided to try to get them to stop. So what he did is there was somebody who was in the area who wasn't wasn't so nice, it wasn't so good. And he got him to be, I don't know, he's like a werewolf. And they got him to as a wolf would come and chase all the kids away. And the next day, you know, he tried to get the kids and they were scared, but he promised the parents and the kids nothing would happen. And then the wolf came again the next day and he stood in front of the wolf and he said whatever he said and the wolf died. They went to Cheder. When they came back, they saw the dead body of this hermit, this bad person who was in the woods. So stories like this are said about the Besht. After 3 years, so then he was taken to the person by the name of Rav Meir, who took care of him, and he also was a hidden tzaddik, and he was also part of a group just like his father was, of tzaddikim, that they would get together and they would be mechazik each other, and they would try to see what they can do for the community at large. And Yisrael became one of them. He would listen in on their meetings and he would become part of them. And at some age he became not only part of them, but they became like almost like one of the leaders. This Rav Adam, two of them in particular, there was this Rav Adam Baal Shem, and he says, or it's said about Rav Adam Baal Shem, would be his longtime mentor and his teaching aid in Rebbe Yisrael's own work. I guess that was somebody who had a tremendous influence on Rebbe Yisrael. When Rebbe Yisrael turned 16, he was visited by Eliyahu HaNavi. He appeared to him and he said, he told him how the greatest thing up in Shemayim, one of the greatest things that made a difference in Shemayim, was the davening of these simple people, even more so than the learning of the Lamdanim. And with that was, I guess, that's like sort of like shaped his goal, his mission in life would be to get these simple people and to make them better, to teach them and make them even more close to Hashem. And what he would do is he would start to engage, he would, you know, start to talk to these simple Jews in conversation about anyday things, and by inquiring about their well-being and family, he was able to get the words of praise of Hashem. Oh, Baruch Hashem, look what Hashem has given me. And that was, you know, that was his understanding of what meant a lot to Hashem, what he heard from Eliyahu HaNavi. When he was 18, so now even though he was going from place to place, the Tlaste community had a wife for him, but she soon died after their marriage. But he says that after this time, this period of his life was one of the nicest periods from the Besht. He was able to meditate. He was alone. He was able to grow in his ruchnius. And then after his wife's death, he was hired again as a teacher in the cheder, and then he became to have understandings of people and. He became like people would ask him for advice, and he would adjudicate between civil matters. I don't know if it meant husbands and wives or other people in the community. And now he's 18. This is where the Carpathian Mountains are. So it's
Slovakia.
Slovakia. Right. So you have it. The Carpathian Mountains go into many countries: Slovakia, Ukraine, and Romania. So these are, he was probably in this area here. This is, I guess, where Tlusk, I'm guessing, would be in the southwest Ukraine. So somewhere probably here is where his, where he was. Okay. He then moved to the town of Brody, once again hired as a teacher. He was able to tutor then, again, he was single still, his wife had passed away. And he was tutoring a young one orphan who was adopted by Rav Gershon of Kitov, and who was also a big Talmud Chacham and big Kabbalist. And because Rav Gershon of Kitov was very impressed with the Besht, he ended up marrying Rav Gershon of Kitov's sister. So that was Chana. So that was going to be who his next second wife is. She gave birth to their daughter, I guess her name is Odel, if I'm saying it right. And their son, 15 years later, Tzvi Hirsch, would be born 15 years later. He was in Brody, and then one of the group there of the Sadiqim, suggested that he leave Brody and he settle in a small village in the Carpathian Mountains to the east. So now he's married, he has one daughter, and he goes, he's out again into a small village. In, yeah. I'm guessing South Ukraine. It could be Slovakia, but I'm guessing it would be around this area. I didn't have it.
Huh? It was probably Poland to that time.
Or maybe, yeah, maybe. Oh, right. This area, Slovakia, now could have been part of Poland. So it's either probably in this area over here, where he was, you know, in South Poland or Western Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing this is where he was. His influence is going to be the Ukraine. In other words, when this is the area that the Jews were decimated
all
from Tachvatan.
All this area on the left side of Dnieper was part of Poland. The right side went to Russia after Khmelnytsky.
Yeah, but that came much later, right?
Yeah,
is the Dnieper? Is this the Dnieper?
No,
it must
Kiev.
Be over here somewhere.
Dnieper goes through Kiev.
Through Kiev, so right. Here. So
Kiev,
it must
yes.
be over here.
Yeah.
So the Dnieper River is about over here. So everything to this side went to Russia, and this side from this area went to Kiev. Yeah, it made sense. But this is the area where. We're going to see it was overrun by the Turks and then back to the Polish nobles. Okay, this time he is married and he was told to move to a small village. And here he became into mining clay and he became this was 7 years here. Was his time to develop himself into the greatness that he was. 1724, 26th birthday. So again, when he turned 18, he was visited by Eliyahu HaNavi. When he turned 26, he was visited by the prophet Achia HaShiloni. Now again, he probably also, just like the Ramchal and others, he probably had a magid, and this magid eventually led him to have other neshamas come talk to him. Now, Achia HaShiloni was, I guess, his navi, his neshama that taught him a lot. He did quote Achia HaShiloni often. Who was Achia HaShiloni? Achia HaShiloni was a student of Moshe Rabbeinu, but he did not become part of the Mesorah until. Eliyahu HaNavi. I think Eliyahu HaNavi learned from Achia HaShiloni. So Achia HaShiloni really lived a long time. As a matter of fact, Achia HaShiloni also was the one that anointed Yeravam ben Nevat, if I'm not mistaken, to become the leader of the 10 tribes that would break off from Yehuda. So he was. This was the Achia HaShiloni that taught Yisrael secrets of the entire Torah. And he says, fine, he taught that a lot of his Torah that he learned from Achia HaShiloni. 1730, he becomes a shochet in, help me out here, Kishlowitz. But he moved away, soon he moved back to Tolos because Rav Gershon Kitov bought him a tavern. To take care of. So when he was in this tavern, villagers taught him herbs and plants and using for refuah, how to use them to heal. And at this point now he started to become known for his healing abilities. So this
pharmacist.
Is pharmacist, but you know, he wouldn't only heal their physical ailments. He was looking to heal their ruchnius ailments too. So he would be not only making, prescribing remedies of certain plants and herbs, but he was also writing amulets. And he became successful as a Baal Shem, a healer. And people from surrounding villages would come to him to help him out with all their problems. Not only that, but again, he taught them the importance of when they come. He taught them, of course, of Torah and joy, encouragement, service of Hashem. And now he became not only a Baal Shem, like people were a Baal Shem, but he was a Baal Shem Tov. He was like a, you know, I guess that's a higher level than just a Baal Shem. Okay, while he, again, as he was expanding his circle, so in 1734, when he turned 36, 6 years after intense unyielding pressure from his mentor, Rabbi Adam Baal Shem, and Achia Shiloni, he decided to go public. That's it. He decided, okay, enough for himself and his personal growth, but now he started to be a darshan, started to go out and teach other people. Okay, he had three things that he was, a number of things, but let's just see, in Jewish thought, in the best view, the simple brachas of just simple Jews was as holy as advanced Torah study. Now you could understand where this could run into people who are advanced Torah scholars would not take too kind to such a statement, where you're saying his simple bracha is the same as your intense learning, which not everybody agreed to that. He also said purity of intent was over achievement. So if you had somebody that tried to do good and he put a serious effort in, so that's better than the person that accomplished a lot but didn't put, it wasn't, I guess, either 100% lishma or didn't do it, you know, for the sake of Hashem. It was easy for him. So he put intent over achievement. Also, joy and humility. That's something which is paramount. I guess if you had to, I guess if we, one of the main things of Hasidus, at least the way the Besht was teaching it, was was joy. Everything had to be done in joy. And also everybody could serve Hashem through prayer, passion and prayer. So this is like a few of the major things that he was giving a drasha. This would also be very helpful against the secret Sabbateans. One of the things that Rav Nathan of Gaza or Shabtai Tzvi, they were insisting that people do with their tikkuns was what? Very intense tikkuns, suffering, putting the body in pain. You know, you have all these averus that you did, and in order to get rid of the chait and remove the chait, you had to put yourself in suffering, you know, whether it was makos or in the cold snow or whatever, fasting. So, I mean, that, you know, those that were into it were into it. But here came along the Besht, and he says, no, that's not the way you serve Hashem. You serve Hashem through joy. So he almost took out the all those secret Sabbateans, you know, that were following in the old footsteps of punishing oneself physically in order to get a spiritual high. The Besht says, you don't have to do it that way. Do it my way. And you get as much, maybe even more. So it was a tremendous draw. You know, people didn't feel like they had to punish themselves. They could serve Hashem with joy and making and blessings and different way to serve Hashem. So it had a tremendous effect on these people that were following.
Is this self-punishment and all that stuff, is that a Jewish thing or is that from the Goyim?
No, it's a Jewish thing. Yeah. I mean, it's brought down, yeah, that there's a school of thought or... Again, that's not what we do. We don't do. We don't do the punishments. I think the Ramchal writes
something that's from the Goyim. Right? If you look in Mesilat Yesharim, he says that it comes from the Goyim.
He does.
He says don't do it. He says don't do it.
But I think he says you shouldn't be like so stupid like the goyim.
Okay, so right, but there is a, you know, there is basis in, you know, to put oneself through these fasting and doing things to, you know, weaken the gashmius in order to strengthen the ruchnius. That's the thrust of it. You know, the gashmius and ruchnius are always at ends with each other, and the more you give into gashmius, the less strength there is to the ruchnius.
Sounds
so when
like
you weaken,
very poor society with a lot of horror in it.
If done in the proper way and for people who were on that level, then it would be the right thing to do. But I guess people who are not on that level and doing this, it would be terrible for them. And here, he again, his movement, his thrust, or at least the beginning of the movement, is for the masses, the simple masses. So these simple masses, what would be the best thing for them? The best thing is to serve Hashem with joy, with enjoyment, to love Hashem, do things with sincerity, daven to Hashem. You know, this is all something that, and it resonated, and people listened, and it, you know, maybe coming after the ideas that were before of the way to come close to Hashem is making it hard on yourself, and you come across, you could be close to Hashem with joy. It's a winner. It's a good, you know, it's a winning argument. All right, so he started to become, when he started to publicize and to darshan and to teach these ideas, so he became very popular and people would come and they would listen. Let's just move in 1740. So now he's 42. He felt that he was sufficiently strong and he finally moved to the small towns of Mezebaj. Am I saying it right? Mezebaj. Mezebaj, okay, and that's, you know, that became the center of Hasidus. From that time on, he remained the rest of his life in Mezebaj, and that's it. People would come, and they would. Not only was he attracting the simple, the God fearing, regular God fearing Jew, but he was attracting great minds and big Talmid Chachamim as well. I mentioned a few here. I don't know who these are, but Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Pulna, Pinchas of Koritz, Rav Dovner, Rav Dov Ber, really. That's going to be the Maggid of Mezebaj, who's going to take over after him. And other scholars, okay? And this is where Hasidism would begin and would spread. In Rosh Hashanah of 1746, again, he's 48 now. He was born in 1698, so whatever year you see, just add two. Many of the greatest minds, they came to study in the court of the Baal Shem Tov. On Rosh Hashanah, he had a vision where as he ascended to heaven and entered the chamber of Mashiach. The Besht asked Mashiach, when will Mashiach come? And Mashiach responded, when your well springs, the teachings of Hasidim will burst forth to the farthest extremes.
I have a question, because now you're starting to use the word court. And that's another aspect of Hasidut that is interesting. That
right.
This following of the tzaddik to such an extent that you completely...
Right. So I hope to get into that more, what the tzaddik was to the masses. I'm sorry? I think of the English court, the English word court here is used as the Hasidus. I think it just means generally that there's a court like a backyard, or a court like, you know, order in the court. But it was like the court means they became part of his group, his Hasidus. I think that's what it means here by court.
Yeah, in Britain, the inns of court or whatever.
All right, right. It's the chevra, the group. Right. So he gave court, and then, you know, Hasidus is going to spread, and you'll have the court of, let's say, Satmar, or the court of Bells and Vishnitz.
They call it a chatzel, and they, to some extent, the Hasidish rabbis act like a king.
Yeah, oh, sure. Some of them,
I'm
yeah, absolutely.
You have a court like a king,
right. It could be.
That's what I was going to say.
Court is an English word. What's the Hebrew word that they use for this?
Chatzel.
They use the word chatzel for this? The chatzel of the... Satmar Chatzer, or the Belzer Chatzer. Okay? All right, anyway, as you could imagine, every time there's anything new, so there's any action begets an equal and opposite reaction. And there was a reaction to this. Again, they were afraid, you know, we already had a Shabbosai Tzvi, and, you know, the this is in 1740s. So this is even before, this is around the time of the Ramchal. So again, they're afraid, is this a new Shabbosai Tzvi? Is this a secret Shabbosai Tzvi? Plus he's saying things that are not, that's not the what we've understood for years on end. The Talmud Chacham Torah is the greatest, and he's like almost putting Torah secondary, right? And again, the question is when he said this, did he really mean it's secondary, or was it Harash Shah? Because he had a whole group of people that didn't have access to Torah. So what could they do? So they could daven. They had the sincerity. They can have joy serving Hashem. Did it mean that always, even when they had the ability to learn, and when they learned, that they almost like shouldn't learn, or they should stress their time being joyful and not learning? I don't know. Again, I'm not in the court of Hasidim, and just will, you know, but yes.
Do you have anything on why he never wrote anything?
Yeah, I think he, I did see what he mentions. I think either he could have been told not to write things, or that's not your job. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's a good question why he didn't write anything. But we're going to see soon that there's a Yaakov Yosef, who the first Hasidic book, Sefer that came out, 1780, was like his Talmud. I'd like to quote from that extensively. So I'm not sure why he himself didn't put things to writing.
He didn't want anything to be misinterpreted.
Okay, maybe not to be interpreted. Okay, I'm not sure. All right, so anyway, so of course you could see the, how could you say that there's that the learning Torah is secondary to anything? And then again, they thought he's like a Shabbosai Tzvi. Okay. However, and in the very beginning, it was very, 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 very intense against Hasidism. And I think there was also more opposition. I don't know if it was opposition to Hasidism in general, and then there was probably opposition to certain sects of the Hasidim individually. But I think within about 50 years or 70 years for sure, things generally worked itself out. In other words, the outside pressures of the Polish government and all the Russian government, all these governments, so the Hasidim and the Litvish, or the Misnagdim as they call themselves, were able to work together to come to a cohesive front against all the outside forces, whether it be the outside forces of reform, or the Enlightenment, or the non-Jews. So, but it did. They
took longer.
Huh?
I think it probably took longer than 70 years.
Well, the initial, the initial arguments were abated a lot. But again, it's, you know, you could probably even say even now there's still like friction, probably much less now than it was 50 years ago, and much less.
After the Holocaust, they realized that you're a Jew, then you're a Jew. You know?
It could be. It could be. Maybe, but I don't know what it was in Europe, maybe, but I'm sure even in the 1900s of Europe, it was less than in the 1800s of Europe, and that was even less than in the early 1800s, late 1700s.
They succeeded against the Haskalah, where the Litvish yeshiva was failed. That's not me saying.
Everybody failed against Haskalah.
Well, we were... Haskalah, at the end of the day, at the end of the day, I guess we really succeeded because we're here today and Haskalah is not. But the question is how much casualties did we sustain to the Haskalah? It was not insignificant in both. So, but yes, if probably Hasidism, if not for Hasidism, the Haskalah would have probably just swept the boards, would have just destroyed Eastern Europe Jewry. The strength that they had did come from both. It came from Hasidism, and in the yeshiva world, especially the Musar movement. The Musar movement was a direct result, a direct pushback to the Haskalah. Okay, but that's, I guess, really, I don't know if we'll get to it next year, maybe we will, but that's in and of itself. The Haskalah is going to be a totally different, if what the Jews had, whatever they had to put up until the Haskalah is going to be a totally different animal, totally different, and it's going to come from within, and it's going to be a... Okay, so okay, and one other thing, where the Besht also directly, I guess more directly, having to do with the Shabtai Tzvi, is we mentioned a few weeks ago about the Frankists. Now these are Frankists. These came from the Dome. Some Dome had these. The Dome were the Shabtai Tzvi that actually converted to Islam, but yet they were still missionizing among the regular Jews, and they converted a person by the name of Jacob Frank, whose father was a secret Sabbatean, and this Frank had a tremendous he was a tremendous mashpia, he was a tremendous person with a influence on other people, and he got people to follow him. Eventually, he would, the Frankists, they became very immoral, and they were put into Cherem, and Jacob Frank went to the church to try to get protection from the church against the Jews. He said, we have more in common with you than the regular Jews. We both believe that there was a Mashiach, like Mashiach came, you know. And the Trinity, he wasn't clear that your Mashiach is not our Mashiach. But in any case, in sort of an outlook of life, they felt close enough. Eventually, and because of Jacob Frank, they're forced to a debate between the Frankists and the church against the Jewish, against the Jews. There were two debates. The first one, the Jews did not really put up a front. They didn't take it seriously. But the second one, they did. And the second one, that's where the Besht came in. The second one, he was chosen to be one of the three delegates representing the rabbis in a highly publicized debate with the Frankists in Lemberg. What's going to end up happening after this debate is that Jacob Frank and all of his people are going to convert to Christianity. And that soon after the debate, thousands of Frankists, they went to Baptist, to demonstrate their loyalty to Christianity. They were forced, they were put pressure on by the church. Yeah, you think you're like us, so let's see, put your money where your mouth is. And they did. And it said about the Baal Shem was very, very saddened. Somehow he felt his mission, he failed his mission. He thought somehow if he can get those Frankists back, again, he had the philosophy, he had the ability. Maybe had they been able to hang on longer, he could have had that effect on them. But he's written about them. He says, he wrote about the Frankists after they converted. He says, as long as a diseased limb is connected to the body, there is hope that it may be saved. Once it's amputated, there is no hope. When they converted to Christianity, that's it. They were all lost. There's no way of getting them back. The Besht, caused the Baal Shem to bear a tremendous amount of distress, and some actually said that he died within the year. Some say that it was caused him so much distress that it actually brought his death, I guess, even prematurely. Okay, this is, again, more about just the Besht. He came in at the right time. The area that the Ukraine or the or Eastern Poland and Western Ukraine was we mentioned the Khmelnytsky massacres. After, at some point later, the Turkish, the occupied, the Muslims, the Turks, ended up coming and grabbing that area. And then at some, then came, you know, there's also Shabtai Tzvi at that time, and yet not only that, throw in also the Frankists. So this place was a very, very harsh place for Jews. It was a poor place. The Jews were poor and they were not able to learn Torah. And then at some point, and this is again in the late 1600s, the Polish noblemen would take it back over, and they would kick out the Turks. And because it was now the new frontier, they were you want to build up your area. The way the best to build it up is with business, commerce, and who better could do that would be the Jews. So now the Jews were being incentivized to come back to that area and to rebuild the area. And it was like having a new rebirth, so to speak, this area. And this is around the time when the Besht is coming. So now it's a new rebirth. There's things going on, things are looking up, and now the Besht is also coming in with like a new philosophy. So everything really went hand in hand. So it was a good time for the Besht to come in, and people were receptive to hear what he had to say. He also gets a reputation for performing miracles, cures desperately ill people, also barren couples, also lots of stories of his miraculous kfitzas haderach. He's able to travel to different places in a tremendously short amount of time. These are all many stories about the Besht, about this. And, you know, I'm sure we've all heard tremendous amount of stories. Like, what's the line that they say? If you don't believe, if you believe them all, you're an Ama Aretz. And if you don't believe any of them, you're an Apikoros. I mean, that's, you know, so you have to know what to believe. You have to take, you know, that's the line that they say about the stories about the Baal Shem. One of these stories is they were, Baal Shem Tov was in shul, and he heard two people into a fight. One person said to the other person, "I'll tear you like pieces of a fish." And then he did something to his Talmidim that they could see, and they got it in a ruchniyah sense. They saw what happened to the victim, the one who was said about, and they saw him torn from piece to piece. Well, like torn like in pieces. And they were, what? And the Baal Shem was trying to show them, you see the power of words. His words up in Shemayim, I guess in a ruchniyah sense, this is what it accomplished. Okay. He dies first day of Shavuos, 1760. For the first year, his son Tzvi Hirsch took over. But on the anniversary of his father's death, he calls a meeting of all the big Rebbes, all the big Hasidim there. And basically he says to them, "I got a dream. My father came to me in a dream, and he told me that the person who should lead the new movement is Rav Dov Baer, who became known as the Maggid of Meserich. And that's, he was the one that set Hasidism in motion. He had a system, and he was very into going out in Kiruv, and he would go out to, maybe you want to call it missionize, but he would go to towns, and he would send people all over the place, and shluchim, and I guess what Chabad does today, this was mainstay of Hasidism in the time of the Maggid of Meserich. Okay, now.
He was a Maggid. His job was going on the road telling stories.
Right, but not only him. He stayed in Meserich. He would send people out, and he'd say, "You have to go there, see what you can do in there." And okay. I wanted to just focus just a little bit about Toldos Yaakov Yosef. I guess that's the name of his book. Toldos Yaakov Yosef was one of the big major students of the Besht. He was familiar with Kabbalah, and he actually was a Rav. But when he started following the Besht, they kicked him out of his job. He lost his job, and he ended up in a different job. Eventually ended up in Nemirov, Right? We mentioned Nemirov in the Tachvatat. I think that was one of the cities that was overrun. And the actually, the cause it, when they made the fast of Tachvatat, they did it on the anniversary of the destruction of Nemirov, if I'm not mistaken. But he was the, and he was a center of Hasidism, where he himself, you know, was very, very active. Now, he put the first Hasidic book, a sefer, I should say, it's not a book, that was published, and it was published in 1780. Again, the Besh passed away in 1760. And he is mainly on the Parshios, and he quotes, when he says, my master, he's referring to the Baal Shem. He never says the Baal Shem by name, but he's referring to the Besht, and he says, my master, and he quotes him, I think, about, what is it, 250 times, 249 times in the Sefer. Okay. So, this is the Sefer, the first page of the book, Toldos Yaakov Yosef. So, he writes in, this is another book that also quotes a lot of his stories. That's Kesser Shem Tov. Okay, what basically he was trying to, in one of his, in Parshas Re'eh, he's writing the, what's so hard about getting these people to change. In other words, you have a community in the Ukraine, a community of people, sincere people, but simple ignoramuses. I guess ignoramus, I'm using the word, but simple, like amaratzim, they don't know too much. And you're trying to get them to change. And it was probably, you know, many people would come, you know, people would come maybe from, more from Poland, maybe from the West, and they would come and they would try to get these people to change. But he would write that it was very, very, very difficult to get these people to change. And he said, like, he says, the people that would come listening to speech, he would divide them into three groups. And this is what he wrote in the Sefer, you know, told us Yaakov Yosef, trying to explain how hard it was to inspire people. He says, first of all, people who came just out of a sense of shame. You know, back then you didn't have any TV or worse or, you know, smart anything. All you had, the only entertainment in town was the darshan. You know, so what if the darshan, if a magid came to town, you went, that was it, that was the form of entertainment, that was it. So if the magid came to town and everybody's going to be there, and you're not, it doesn't look good. So, all right, people would come, but they weren't listening to the message. They went because they felt that they had to be there. Second group is, ooh, they would listen. Oh, that's a good idea, good, you know, and they'd listen to the magid, and they'd listen to the speaker. But as soon as they left the door, that's it. You know, they were better, they're onto whatever their lives were at. And they would, you know, they wouldn't, they'd be in, their inspiration would leave when they left the shul. And they would, like, you know, the Eight Sahara would argue, it's enough, you came to listen, do you really have to change? Do you have to, you know, you have to make yourself a better, a different person? And that was the set. And the third was those that, in fact, didn't even come to the shmooze. So here you have, so who are you talking to? Most of the people, they're only there because they feel they have to. Those listen, ooh, it's a good idea, but they forget about it as soon as they leave. And there are people that didn't even show up. And he's saying this is the culture, or this is the situation that was in there at the time. He says there are, again, he also quoted the name of Rav Polanya, Rav Arya Leib Glinner. He says, yeah, darshan would come to speak. There are relatively few listeners, I guess, people that would really listen. So why don't they want to listen? Because one of two things. Why would they want to come? Either because if they would come and they would listen, so then they would be forced to have to listen to what he has to say. And that would be humbling. I'd have to change. I'd have to make myself, you know, different. But if I don't listen, then there's like these curses and these like things that say that if I don't listen, then it says that the tzaddik will take the Russia's portion, and the Russia would take from the tzaddik's bad portion. And like, you know, here I am, the tzaddik is telling me to change. I'm not listening, so he's going to get all my good and I'm not going to get anything. So why should I come? Either I'll have to change, which is I have to change everything about me, or if I don't change, I lose it all to the tzaddik. So this is the mindset that that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was trying to tell. This is what the preachers, what the people were up against. Second of all is they say, like, they don't know who this guy is. This guy's getting up and saying, oh, you got to be better and you got to daven better and you got to do this. But who are you? How do I know if I went to your town, you'd be me? You know, I don't know, do you always go to a minyan? How's your learning? How's your midos? Like, we have no idea. We don't know who you are. We have no idea what the, you know, a chazan on the other hand, oh, what is he? I don't have to change. Chazan comes to town, everybody comes to listen. I guess they knew when the chazan came to town, there were more people listening than the darshan. Chazan doesn't not ask me to change. I hear a nice voice, and that's it. I go further. He also says, the way to start to change things is with halacha, you know, in order to have a certain amount of chashivas of a person, in order to build people up, you have to teach them halacha. We bear witness to the absolute esteem in which Torah scholars are held in the eyes of the masses. They take a look at the Torah scholars and they don't want to have anything to do with them, and they're not they look down at them. And he says that, you know, you should try to, one should speak praises of study of halacha, and therefore, like, things like Hashem only occupies, he only has the Dalet Amos of halacha, and you should try to do things to try to get these people to appreciate learning more and to change. I'm thinking now that I'm just looking at the time, and I would think I'd like to next time, just Rabbi Yaakov Yosef has certain ideas, and he brings out the best ideas on how to deal with the masses, and things that. And what to do to change, and things that could be done or should be done. And maybe I think we're going to pick this up more with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef next week. So we've done the life of the Besht and his influence. Now we're going to do what his ideas, his philosophy, and how the revolution that he's going to cause through his philosophy with the masses. I guess we'll pick this up next week. What you know, and we'll start through Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, through his sefer, because everything he's saying he got from the Besht, and what he says, you get an idea of what his issues were at the time and how he felt that the Besht, the ideas of the Besht would change things. Question.
Do you know how long the Besht lived? How old?
Yeah, he was 62. He was 1768 to 1760. I think we have his kever. Hold on. I don't know what. Let's just see if I can. How quick. Oh, okay. What do I got here? This is his shul that was destroyed by the Nazis but has been rebuilt exact to the pictures. This is a sitter of his. This is a well that he dug, still working today. That's it. Resting place in the town of Mezhebuz. Yes, that's it. That's his kever. It's been redone. Yeah, the old pictures of what the kever looked like. So he is buried in Mezhebuz.
It's 62.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. So tomorrow, next week, in Mitzvah Hashem, we'll go into his philosophy and how it changed the people.